You're listening to the Future Tech Health Podcast with Richard Jacobs. Until I reached age 40, I never realized the obvious, that we all have medical issues, or we at least have a family member or close relation that had, has, or will have them in the future. Medicine and biological systems are the final frontier. Until we've conquered death, figured out how life began, cured cancer, and understood our purpose in the universe, there's a heck of a lot to talk about when it comes to our health. Future Tech Health means I'll be covering futuristic topics that are actually already in clinical trials, or even starting to appear on shelves or by prescription, or available for your own use. We dive deep into stem cells, CRISPR-Cas9, the science of sleep, epigenetics, medical testing, cancer, ketogenic diets, stem cells, aging, regenerative medicine, and more. My goal for you, the listener, is to learn from these podcasts. You may very well learn something that may change the course of your life for the better, steer you towards a new career, or give you insight into addressing a serious medical problem. Remember, however, this podcast and its content is informational in nature only. No medical, tax, legal, financial, or psychological advice is being given. If you enjoy the podcast, please listen, subscribe, like, and share it with friends. Thank you. Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Future Tech and Future Tech Health Podcast. And I have Dr. Indra Sadambi. She works at the in addiction medicine at the Center for Network Therapy. She's recognized as a leading expert pioneer in the field of addiction medicine. And she founded the Center for Network Therapy, New Jersey's first state-licensed ambulatory, which means outpatient detoxification care and treatment facility. And she's serving currently as its medical director. So, Dr. Sadambi, thanks for coming. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you, Richard, for inviting me to the podcast program today.
Yeah, what got you interested in addiction medicine in the first place?
During my psychiatric residency, I had an opportunity to rotate through an addiction treatment program. And that's when I found that this field was interesting because where I got my training, they did not have the addiction training in depth. So we were asked to go from Maimonides, which is in Brooklyn, to go to Coney Island Hospital to get the rotation. So it kind of made me feel that something which I was afraid of, like every time when I was on call, I didn't want to have to deal with an addicted patient coming in because I didn't know what to do with the patient. So once I had that rotation of training from Coney Island, it kind of made me feel comfortable. I thought I kind of conquered the world or something. No longer had to have the fear. So that was my interest. Yes, that's how we got into it.
I've been to Coney Island, and Coney Island itself can be, I guess, just make a bad joke.
Yes.
That's a good place. Okay. So what about it? I mean, you were afraid. It was a personal challenge for you to overcome it, which is great. But then what kept you working there and what kept you wanting to be involved in it?
Because I started feeling that not everyone who suffers from the disease of addiction is able to access treatment. That was the first thing that I came to conclusion, like, you know, I have to come to that concept that not everyone who suffers is able to access treatment. Being a physician, that was very hard for me to digest. The result is that we see so many preventable overdose deaths that keeps happening. I would like that to change. So I think reducing stigma associated with the disease of addiction and moving more treatment to an outpatient setting will greatly increase the access to care. So that became my goal and my vision. And so I introduced the concept of outpatient detoxification. Most of it is mostly in an inpatient setting, so that so many people who had the stigma and where the insurance did not cover those inpatient treatment, they were able to access treatment at an appropriate time. So that was the vision and the mission for.
So what are some of the traditional inpatient treatments? And then, you know, I want to discuss how yours is.
Oh, okay. Traditional model is inpatient. Inpatient model, I have to admit that once someone gets to be diagnosed with addictive disorders, they were asked to go away to be in an inpatient setting to sober up. And then when they step down to an outpatient clinic, by the time they would go back to an outpatient treatment, they would relapse and again either have an overdose and death and or get revived because of their tolerance has gone down. So that's what makes it tricky when they have to do an inpatient treatment. So I thought this outpatient model is wonderful in that it incorporates everything. Like their stress is still being addressed while they are in treatment. And so they are not like stepping down dramatically from a fully structured environment to their back to their chaotic environment. So that's a positive outlook.
And what drugs require significant intervention and which ones don't seem to be as harmful? You know, if you compare alcoholism, you know, addiction to heroin or meth, you know, what's it like amidst the different drugs and substances?
So in terms of the detoxification, I would say there is a challenge when we are detoxing anybody who is abusing alcohol and or benzodiazepines. Because it's life-threatening, people can die when they're detoxing off of those two. But then opiates, as much as we say it is so like abusing heroin, from detoxification, nobody will die. And so it's not a big risk to detoxify them at an outpatient level. But then having worked at an outpatient detox center for close to 7 years now, I can tell you more than 60% of the patients can be easily detoxed as an outpatient.
So what kind of trends are you seeing in drug addiction use? Is it more prescriptions like OxyContin, oxycodone, or is it more illegal drugs? What do you see?
So there was a big change in the whole spectrum. Earlier in my career, I saw like a lot of patients were using prescription drugs. It was always like pain medication. But then due to the loud noise in the past 1.5 years, the prescription pain pills has been reduced. But then sadly enough, there are so many people using straight heroin. And the heroin is tainted with fentanyl. And so you do see that mishap of overdose and death. And so that's a sad thing. And not only that, you know, people who are buying pills online, like they would get some Xanax, like which is a anti-anxiety medication, and they would think they were taking Xanax, which they bought online. But then when we drug test them, they would come out positive for fentanyl. And when we confront them, they would say, I did not do anything but for this pill. And so it's scary, you know?
Yeah, it's like you're damned if you do it, you're damned if you don't. You can buy drugs from... So is this people buying drugs from the dark web or Canadian pharmacies, or where do people get these pills?
It depends. You know, mostly the kids between the ages of 19 and 25, I would see those patients are like constantly, you know, talking about the dark web. And I even had one patient teach me how to get on and off, like, you know, how to order stuff. And I was like taken aback. That was like a short brief course that he gave me, so for me to understand how he did it, which that's the only way for as an addiction psychiatrist I can really learn stuff. Otherwise we don't have books, or nor did we get trained to this extent. It's quite an evolving and a challenging field, I come to realize. And so that's something that you see in that age group moving along, like, you know, people in their mid-30s and into 40s, they go somewhat justifying what they buy online from online pharmacies and stuff like that. And, you know, older than that, those who have enough money, they would be like buying Kratom and think, oh, this is something I can help myself to come off of opiates, only to know that Kratom is, again, an addictive substance like opiates. And so, you know, it's a challenge now. One after the other, they'll come in and tell you, like, I didn't even know this was addictive.
Yeah, it might be obvious, but what is challenging about it? Is it that a lot of these drugs have a very high relapse rate, or is it that, the people themselves just mentally, they want to quit, but they can't? I mean, what are the big challenges in helping people?
I see that there are misconceptions, there are myths that the public has already formed in their head about addiction, and then the challenge about having stigma attached to substance use. So, you know, continuing where I was, touching upon a long-time misconception, we can see that addiction was a behavior issue and not a disease. That's where it all started. People used to say, just go to 12-step meetings and you should have your willpower. Don't take any medication. So it's not a disease. It's all what you wanted to do. So you made the mistake. You should correct it. That was the first misconception that they had. And I think the dominance has been that addiction was a behavior issue and not a disease. And now then the inpatient model came from this belief, the need to isolate individuals suffering from this disease from the society until they learn to change the way they behave. So, but now addiction has been proved to be a disease, and it's treated like a chronic disease. So why is this inpatient treatment still dominating? You know, that is my biggest question. And I would say that investments already made by inpatient providers in the inpatient model keeps it going, because they put in so much money, they don't want to say now addiction can easily be treated as an outpatient. But I think inpatient treatment also keeps the stigma associated with the addiction going. So if someone gets caught by the loved ones, now they have to like get isolated, they need to get away from the family. That means they need to explain to the children and to the other family members, like siblings, you know, and also to talk about this to their employers when they come back, the missing days, you know. So there's so much of stigma associated.
So what's the difference between inpatient versus what you do? What are some of the key differences?
Essentially, my model, which is the ambulatory detox, which is totally an outpatient model, and enabled individuals suffering from addiction to access treatment from their living environment. I have found it to be powerful. Just think about it. You know, there is little stigma associated with treatment, as you are not sent away from home for a long period of time. And then you also see that you get to learn to stay sober in your own living environment. So we have found it delivers far better results compared to the inpatient treatment. When I say that, Richard, it's like 65% of our patients are sober over 90 days. When you compare that to an inpatient, it's 40%. So you do see a dramatic success rate with this model.
But what are some of the key elements that help people with addiction? Like, what kind of things do they do, whether it's inpatient or outpatient? What are the common things that they need to do?
Number one thing is that, you know, addressing the myth and saying that I need to hit rock bottom in order to get treatment. That's not true. Anybody with this chronic disease, if they embrace this as a chronic disease, they can really look at it the way they will look at any other chronic illnesses like diabetes or high blood pressure and say, hey, I have a problem. There is a solution to it. Let me go. There is no cure, but there is a fix. So once they are in that boat, it gets easier. They need to seek for appropriate treatment. The number one step will be to detox themselves from the medication with the help of a professional. And then, the problem again is after the detox, a patient might say, I can do this. I'm no longer using. I'm all cured. So that's a pitfall again. And so they need to like continue with the treatment, which is the partial care. The partial care is where they will be getting treatment for other comorbidities. What I mean by that, if they have any medical issues and or the psychiatric issues like the depression and anxiety, needs to be addressed in the partial care. And then they go down to an intensive outpatient clinic, which will be the evening program and or the daytime program, depending upon where, you know, who provides that. And once they are enrolled in that, they'll be like they will go back to work and they will integrate their daily lifestyle with the treatment model. So that teaches them a healthy coping skill. And also going on a medication-assisted treatment, which is a huge pushback from the community, because most people who have recovered treat addicted patients. And so those who are in recovery as a therapist and or the treatment provider, they would say, you don't have to take any medication because you're going to substitute one medication for the other. And so this has been a challenge again. So I think going through detox, partial care, intensive outpatient, and staying on a medication-assisted program will definitely show improvement with anybody who's been addicted to drugs and or alcohol.
So physically and mentally, I would assume that detox is the hardest part at the beginning.
That's true. And they are also in such a huge denial. They don't want to do it, and they're not feeling good physically. And it's a stigma and everything put together. And so that's one of the reasons why I, chose the outpatient ambulatory model. So that kind of gives that person who's suffering from addiction some control. And I always tell my patients, believe it or not, you are the driver. Me as a treating physician is just a navigator. So I'll be annoying you, but you make your own decisions. So that makes it much more palatable, like they are comfortable with that model.
Do you notice that when people come in, is it a big component that they feel bad about themselves, like they just have no self-control and they're a loser and all that because of what society says about addicts?
Yes, they come in with three things. They come in with the guilt, They come in with, you know, the feeling that they blame themselves for everything. And then they feel also self-pity, like, you know, my family really does not understand me. The trust issues, something I need to work on. So at the end of the day, they just feel that they are not worth anything. And so we need to work on showing their strengths and then, you know, point to them that this addiction is just a faulty coping skill. So once they learn that, we see the improvement in the treatment. Then they show a dramatic improvement.
Okay. How long is the program typically? Is it individual where everyone's totally different, or does it tend to go along a certain path?
So one size does not fit all. Having said that, I would also say if it is just a single drug and or an alcohol, it'll be a shorter period of time. So if someone just uses opiate, then it's just a 7 to 8 days of an outpatient ambulatory detox. After they are detoxed from the medication, then they move on to 2 weeks of Monday through Friday, 9 to 3 p.m. of partial care. And then they step down to IOP, which is an intensive outpatient, 3 times a week, or some places they would offer it for 4 times a week, 3 hours each day. So it can be either in the daytime or in the evening, depending upon what are the needs of the patient. If somebody is working daytime, they would prefer coming to an evening program, or some people work evening, so they would go to a daytime program. So that's what is expected in terms of single drug and or alcohol. But if they are mixing, say, alcohol with benzodiazepine, that might add a couple of days. You know, that's pretty much the norm.
How does someone detox, though, on an outpatient basis? I mean, I would guess maybe what, the first night is the hardest? Or
we medicate it so well that they don't feel any bump. It's not that, you know, what is challenging for an outpatient model is that, you know, the person who has been using, you know, comes for treatment and then goes back to his own environment where they have been using to start with. That is a challenge. So you don't want that person going back home where they were using last night. Maybe they have leftover heroin and or alcohol. So we have to bring in the family, educate them and tell them like this needs to be removed from the house so there is no access. And then also teach them about the medication that they took in the ambulatory detoxification program and say what are the fall precautions and stuff like that. So giving them a good understanding of what to expect makes it much easier. It's not challenging as you would think. You know, it's pretty easy. Like we have been doing this and people are different age group. I would even say 60, 70 years of age. They're very comfortable going through this ambulatory detox.
So what kinds of medications do people have in various situations, and what does it do to them? How do they work?
So ambulatory detox is no different from the inpatient detox in terms of the medication. The way it works is that we store medication in-house. So it feels like when a patient comes in, they get an evaluation done and we start medicating them right away so they don't have to wait. And that is one of the biggest concerns, because when you take someone for inpatient, they get the evaluation, they're waiting to be admitted to the unit. And so they bring in their own drugs and sneak it in the bathroom and take them there too, because they don't, they are afraid of going through withdrawal. So that has been eliminated in an ambulatory detox. So they get medicated right away. And then we monitor them the whole day. And we use the similar medication that they use in inpatient detoxification. For example, if we are dealing with opiates, we do use Suboxone to detox them. Half of opiates that they have been using. If it is alcohol, we'll be using similar to Librium that they use in patients. And so then we'll also give supportive medications for their muscle aches and nausea and to prevent seizures and stuff like that. So they get all those medications monitored by a nurse, and at the end of the day, they get the last dose and they go home. They have been medicated to their needs. So till the next day morning, they don't go through withdrawal and they come back morning ready to get the next dose of medication. So it makes it much easier. Most times my patient would tell me I slept like a baby when I went home. So that kind of helps. Yeah, that's really helpful. And we have mastered this after, you know, working with these patients for, as I said, this is my 8th year. And definitely this model works pretty good.
The patients that go through your program, have they been through other programs before? Were there a lot of first-timers? You know, if they've been through other programs, what do they say about yours?
So most of them, like I would say 70% of my patients have been through several inpatient treatment in the past. And so when they come to my program, this is one thing I've always heard from my patients. They tell me like how easy it is to come to the program and get what they wanted. And number two, they also say you don't get treated like a number. You're not a number. You're a human. You treat us the way we are supposed to be treated, and we don't feel our needs have been neglected. And the third strong point that they say is that not only me as a patient, but also my family gets to hear the struggle that we go through using and also kicking these drugs out of our system. So it's more so like a bridge between the family and the person. So they really like this model.
You have, you said, I think your model, the recidivism rate is what, 30% as compared to 50 or 60?
The inpatient treatment, the results were like, you know, so I gave you the positive one. It delivers better results when you compare to inpatient treatment. We give 65% of our patients remain sober for over 90 days. When you compare that to inpatient, only 40% of those inpatient treated patients remain sober.
When do people relapse, and what events precipitate that? Is it like a big life event, like divorce or loss of a job, or is it just time where they seem to fall back?
The relapse happens in many different ways. So when a person comes for detoxification to our outpatient model, there is a thin boundary line because they're going back to the same environment where they've been using. So their relapse rate is pretty high in the first couple of days, but then their tolerance level has not gone down. So we are able to bring them back, show them where they made a mistake, and correct the whole environment, and get the family member. If they had a fight with the family member, we would bring in and the family member and do the therapy with them so that the conflict resolution happens right then and right there. So going along with the course of treatment after detox, if they are in their partial care and if they have a relapse, we would like to see that as a lapse and not like a relapse. So they don't run with it. They come back and they work on this stuff and they tell us, like, you know, if I'm a patient with heroin use, if the patient went home during partial care and had a glass of wine, we would still consider that as a relapse, and we would tell them, like, listen, this is not your drug of choice, but then if you continue to drink, it'll disinhibit you, the impulsivity increases, and then you would end up using your drug of choice, so you don't want to do that. So we are able to kind of reason out with them and move them along the line of treatment. And then when they are relapsing in an intensive outpatient, that is a challenge because they are away from drugs and alcohol for a while, and the tolerance levels have gone down, and that makes it riskier because they can overdose at that point in time. So what keeps it less of a relapse during intensive outpatient is a therapy and also doing drug tests on a continuum basis. Like, you know, they come in 3 times a week and we are working with them, meaningfully. And that kind of shows them that they can stay away from these relapses. And we tell them always, relapse doesn't happen, you know, all of a sudden. There are warning signs. And so we teach them how to look for that.
When people fall back, you know, and they start using again, do they tend to go to the same program, or do they have bad memories associated with them, go to a different program? That was bad that you have more people that come back to you versus other programs that felt bad about the experience.
Most times the patients, coming from other programs, what I hear from them is that I started using and I didn't go back to my program and they kicked me out. Those are the kind of statements that my patients commonly come out and tell me. And I laugh at them and I tell them, if you're thinking that I'm going to kick you out, I will not. And they raise their eyebrows and ask me, what did you say? And I say, it's easy for me to kick you out and it's easy for you to go out and use. But it's harder for you to come back and own up to the thing and, you know, be in treatment with me, because that's what teaches you how not to relapse. And so they like that. So every time we have a relapse, we reason out with them. We sit down and ask them, what happened? You've been in treatment. You're doing good. So did you use any of these skills that you've learned? Did you put them into practice? Did you fight your relapse? Oh, I didn't. And so they kind of come to a self-realization and they say, gee, I should put what I learned, you know, into practice on a daily basis.
Yeah, what are the main reasons you see that people relapse?
Poor coping skills. Does not want to feel the way they feel. And, you know, if you really talk to any of these people who are using drugs, initially they enjoyed using drugs. After a point in time when it is like really eaten up their day-to-day life, they become a slave to the drug, lack of a better word. So that slavery really makes them want to stop using, but they don't know how to. So when they come seeking for treatment, Some of them are already at that phase of life, and they would tell me, I'm tired of using, help me not to. So then it gets easy. So the honeymoon period is over, and after that, it's one big fight within themselves and with the family members.
How long are people addicts typically when by the time that they come to you?
It all depends. Sometimes I do have patients who would like find me online, and they'll come in right off the bat, and they'll tell me, I've been using for the past couple of months. I don't think I'm in the right path, and I want to stop. That'll be like very a handful of patients, but then most of them would have had different kind of treatments, and they have not been treated right. For example, I have had patients who have been drinking and gone sober for a few months and again restarted drinking. And then when I do the eval, I always sit down with them and ask them what made them go back to drinking. And then I slowly find out they had no anti-craving medication. They did not go for any 12-step meetings, and or they didn't have an individual therapy if they had some problems going on in the family. So based on what they bring to the table, I kind of do the corrective measures when they start treatment with me, and we go through everything, and I always show them, had you been on this particular medication and had you not had that craving, you wouldn't be sitting here today. This relapse could have been prevented, and that, you know, kind of lights a bulb, you know.
What are some of the most important coping skills that you could describe, one or two, for listeners?
Sure. The coping skills are much common. One is like frustration, anxiety, not sleeping. So all these stuff, like they get frustrated because they're not sleeping, and they are awake when the family members are asleep. So the very first thing that they want to do is either drink or use the drug in order to cope with the situation. So, and also anxiety, they feel like, I'm anxious. I want something to cut down my anxiety right away. I want instant gratification. So what we teach them is like there is something that they can really work on, which is the relapse prevention techniques, identifying the triggers, identifying their weaknesses, their strength, and making that as a coping mechanism, healthy coping mechanism, instead of turning back to their unhealthy ones that they've already formed. That really helps. And go to the treatment program wherever they are at, be able to sit down with the therapist and talk about the relapse in a meaningful way, instead of having to hide the details about their use. I think that is the best thing that I can give as a tip for any listeners today. Being real, as long as they are not hiding anything from their treatment providers, they are making progress, because the trained ones know what to do. But if the person who is struggling with addiction does not open up, then it takes more time for them.
Okay. Any, you don't have to name names, obviously, but any cases that really stick out in your mind, memorable cases or situations?
Sure. Once I was in my private practice, sitting across the patient, and I saw something green in the neck of the patient, right below the hairline on the side. So when I looked at it, I said, what is that? And then the patient goes, I use crocodile, and it's something that I inject into my veins, and it turns my skin into this green crocodile kind of a skin. I was taken aback. I thought it was a tattoo or something, you know. So I didn't even know what crocodile was at that point in time when I was sitting right in front of my chin. And I admitted, first thing I said was, oh, gee, I don't know anything about this. Where do you get this drug from? And took a crash course from the patient, and the patient did appreciate that I didn't try to pretend that I knew everything, and I said, I don't know. So I brought the patient back, and I found out that this was exactly like heroin detox, and so I reasoned out with the patient, and we did the further treatment. So that was a learning thing, and it was a multiple thing that went in my head, like saying that, oh my God, I don't know everything, run into these patients, what they are using and how they are using this drug and what are the consequences, how do you detox them? So that kind of made me feel that I don't know everything, but then there's so much more to learn in the industry. We as treaters can be of any productive, citizen here is by being open, accepting that we don't know certain things, coming to terms about how to learn more about this and really keep up with the patient. So that's one of the striking ones that I had. And to follow that, I also had patients who were 19 years old using all the research materials, which I couldn't even, remember what they were at that point in time. They used to give me all those numbers like C19 and this, and so I had to learn again what were they. And when they were using bath salts, I used to have patients walk in and withdrawal symptoms, and I wouldn't even know. It looks like stimulant, it feels like something else, and they are getting psychotic. What's going on here, So it's a mixed kind of a bag that they present with, and then we need to find out what's going on. It's putting the puzzles together. So it's quite exciting for me, and it's always a learning. I don't know, even after working so many years in the addiction field, I still don't know what's coming through that door.
So not everyone in the world, unfortunately, can go see you. So what do you do about getting other centers set up or other doctors to do the same kind of treatment protocol that's worked so well for you?
I have to admit, I'm quite frustrated by the inertia of the inpatient model. I believe that the outpatient model would catch on given its advantages, but it has not caught on as fast as I thought. But I do believe that the outpatient model to treat addiction is the future and will come to dominate treatment. Because it lowers stigma and cost and improves the outcomes. So I think more and more having outpatient clinic as an ambulatory detox across the state and across the country will really help lower the stigma, and patients can really get the appropriate treatment.
Well, very good. So again, for people that could possibly see you, what areas do you cover geographically? And then I'll ask you for a resource for people that can't come see you, but are non-local. So for local people, where is local and how could they get in touch?
So I am in New Jersey, and we have the first detox center, which was opened 7 years ago in Middlesex, New Jersey. It's 333 Cedar Avenue, Middlesex, New Jersey. And their number there is 732-560-1080. And then we also opened an ambulatory detox in West Orange, New Jersey, which is very much accessible by the North Jersey people. Middlesex is more for the Central Jersey, and some parts of South Jersey can still go to my Middlesex center. But we are also in the process of opening one more center in South Jersey, which will be hopefully open up this year in Freehold. So we pretty much have a good grasp of Central Jersey and North Jersey at this point in time.
Okay. Well, very good. And for people that aren't local to you but want help, what do you recommend they do? What are some resources for them?
I would say they shouldn't run away from their state. They should first of all try to stick to their local treatment centers and go with the continuum of care. As I said, do the detox, work with their outpatient clinic, and do the step down treatment till the end of it, instead of just taking bits and pieces. Like I just take the withdrawal management and then think everything is okay, or skip the other modalities and just go to a private doctor and see the doctor once a month. Those kind of treatment is not preferable. So it's a chronic disease and one has to treat it like any other. And I think, having said that thing, other chronic diseases like even HIV, which is quite contagious, have been largely treated as an outpatient basis. Why addiction is directly sent to an inpatient? That's my question all the time. And so I think if we make it as an outpatient, more people will be able to access treatment, because it's not as cost taxing for insurance companies. And it's also more integration of the family environment in the treatment.
I just had a quick insight. I think that it's inpatient based, because I think a lot of people and professionals think of it as a psychiatric problem. You mentioned lack of willpower or lack of wants, or a mental illness, not even just a physical disease. So I think just psychiatric patients maybe committed towards the old school model. I think that's just my feeling, that addiction probably has followed the same path, and that's why there's so much inpatient type stuff because of how it's viewed. That's just my guess.
No, right from the beginning, it was just they didn't have any other model, Richard. They just had inpatient model, and they used to do 30-day treatment, 28-day treatment, and insurance used to cover for those. They would go there and they'll remain sober. But the longer you're in treatment, the better it is. And some people would go away for a year, and then they come back to their family. By the time the family has moved on without that loved one, being part of day-to-day activities. So for the person who comes back, it becomes very difficult for them to reintegrate it into their own family, you know, lifestyle. So I think the model has been what it has been. And only now we are looking at more and more outpatient model. And, you know, the struggle, as I said, was whether it was a disease or not. Now we know, we all come to consensus that this is a chronic disease. And I keep saying, if you believe that this is a chronic disease, treat it like any other chronic disease and you will see the success. And, you know, we also see criminal justice system jumping on this wagon, you know. So it's one thing, they're taken away, they've been put away in a structured environment, and the criminal justice system is all over the map with them. So it feels as if they're criminals, you know. But it smells like criminal activity. It feels like that, but that's not what it is. And we need to, like, really work with this patient as a chronic illness.
Well, very good. Well, Dr. Sanami, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Future Tech Health Podcast with Richard Jacobs. Until I reached age 40, I never realized the obvious, that we all have medical issues. Or we at least have a family member or close relation that had, has, or will have them in the future. Medicine and biological systems are the final frontier. Until we've conquered death, figured out how life began, cured cancer, and understood our purpose in the universe, there's a heck of a lot to talk about when it comes to our health. Future Tech Health means I'll be covering futuristic topics that are actually already in clinical trials, or even starting to appear on shelves or by prescription, or available for your own use. We dive deep into stem cells, CRISPR-Cas9, the science of sleep, epigenetics, medical testing, cancer, ketogenic diets, stem cells, aging, regenerative medicine, and more. My goal for you, the listener, is to learn from these podcasts. You may very well learn something that may change the course of your life for the better, steer you towards a new career, or give you insight into addressing a serious medical problem. Remember, however, this podcast and its content is informational in nature only. No medical, tax, legal, financial, or psychological advice is being given. If you enjoy the podcast, please listen, subscribe, like, and share it with friends. Thank you.